Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jeff Passoff from Dignity Transport. So what can you tell me about Dignity Transport?
Well, we're a transportation company for people with special needs that started in 1990. We try to basically accommodate everything. We've tried over the years to make sure we have, you know, vehicles that are as people want them.
So
not just the minivan, we went to the big vans. Then we've gone to small buses. We have the limousine.
So
all wheelchair accessible.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of how you make it adapted for someone with a mobility issue?
What we've basically done is we've tried to make our vehicles as accommodating as possible. So it's flip seats, it's seats that can move. The vehicles themselves, either we start with the minivan, which are always with a ramp because they lower the floor and it's a ramp-equipped vehicle. And once the wheelchair's inside, there's, you know, the wheelchair itself is strapped down using a proper restraining system that anchors it to the floor to make it as safe as any seat in the vehicle. And then we have seat belts and lap belt and shoulder belts to make sure that all customers are nice and safe. We have larger vehicles that have like a electric lift on them, hydraulic lift that, you know, brings people up because the vehicles are too high to put a ramp onto, because the ramp would either be too steep or too long, depending, because there are rules that govern how the angle you're allowed to use. Although recently when the Dodge ProMaster came out, because it's front-wheel drive, we've been able to get larger vehicles that you can, like, lower the back end and use a ramp, because we have run into the odd issue in the past with people with larger enough wheelchairs they can't go in a minivan, but they're afraid to go on the lift. The interior of the vehicles, as you get into the larger vehicles, are very adaptable, so seats sleep up and down, or they you know, can come in and out or move into different spots so that we can accommodate whatever the crowd wants. We have vehicles that'll hold anywhere from one wheelchair to eight. We have vehicles with a wheelchair that'll hold up to 27 other passengers.
So
we sort of run the whole gambit.
So what types of disabilities do you most commonly see in your work?
Well, we deal mainly with people whose disability have to do with their own mobility. I mean, we really started out specializing with people using wheelchairs. But we're now dealing with a lot of, we deal with people with cognitive issues. We're dealing with a lot of autistic children, where other companies won't transport them. Unless they're accompanied, and we don't require that. But our specialty is still, you know, if you really want to look at our core business, is still dealing with people who are using wheelchairs.
So when you mention about you'll take on autistic children without accompaniment, why do you think it is other companies don't do this?
Because I think it's based on the fact that there are very few companies that specialize in what we do. So we actually spend the time to teach the drivers, train them, and have the research to show them, you know, the best ways to handle the situation. We're very careful with always know exactly who's going for the run. So it's not like, you know, taxi company where it's taxi, you know, 1, 2, 3, but the taxi company has no idea who the driver is, necessarily who the driver is, because a lot of taxi garages, like, they, it's shift rental. So the guy goes in, he has a taxi license, he rents the car. So, you know, the guy could have been driving taxi for a week and a half. Who knows? We don't do that. So, we know who's driving. We know who's capable of doing what. And our drivers have been trained to deal with it.
So, in your time with the company, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
A success story that stands out? I mean, I thought there's one particular thing. Where we've seen a lot of successes, like individual successes, is with autistic children. Because, for example, we do a lot of work for the school board. And watching some of the relationships grow between driver and the child they're transporting, because, you know, the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I'll put the same driver with the same child year after year after year if we have a child. And we've seen some very strong bonds build up with these children over time. I mean, I have one, my favorite story is a father complaining to me one day that even if he's going to the school, for a meeting or something, or there's a performance, he can't take the child with him. The child knows that the driver is Aslan, and Aslan's coming to get him in the morning with dignity, and, you know, that's the way it goes. Can't change it. So some of those bonds, I think, are very special in the long run.
So there's sort of that consistency factor in play, because for a child with a disability, a lot of cases, having that consistent driver, that knowledge they will be safe, is something very important.
Yeah, a lot of autistic kids, especially, everything's about routine. So we keep the routine, you know, and why have when it's a regular run with the child going at the same time every day, or, you know, whatever days they're going, we do everything possible to keep the same driver on the run.
So can you tell me a little bit about some of the people and what sort of training they go through to deal with a person with a disability?
Well, the training we provide, it's all, we do our own training. I haven't really found anything that, you know, encompasses everything we want to do. So we've taken pieces from other places. But we start off on our training program. We've developed our own internal training material, I guess we'll call it. I mean, again, taking bits and pieces from various places. They spend 3 or 4 hours in-house going over that type, you know, going over the basics of what they're supposed to do. We provide them with additional reading material, some video stuff. From there, we do have them watch. Recently, we've switched over the people who manufacture the restraining things for the wheelchairs. I've come up with a really, really good online teaching course that we use. We do make them all go through it to get all the details. But I think the biggest thing we do that nobody else in our industry seems to do is I have drivers who've been with the company almost as long as I have, and I've been here 21 years. And I use those drivers to train other drivers. So one of the things they must go through is not just the in-class or whatever else, it's the practical. It's going out on the road with an experienced driver and seeing what to do and, you know, having an example of how to handle things.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Next segment of our show, we'll hear from Vicky Spadoni, who'll be telling us a little bit about autism dogs. Tell me a little bit about Autism Dogs.
So Autism Dog Services was founded in 2007, and what we do is train dogs to become autism service dogs to children and youth and young adults with autism. And we've been successfully doing that since we were founded, and we received our charitable status, in 2010.
So can you tell me a little bit about the impact that having a service dog can have for a person with autism?
Oh, the impact is huge. First and foremost, we train our dogs to provide safety. So what that means is the child or youth can be tethered to the dog's jacket that they wear. And prime example, when I say these dogs save lives, they really do. So example being is one of the parents is getting their dog out of their car in a busy mall parking lot or, you know, bus depot, train station, wherever, grocery store. And they get the dog out first and give the dog the command to sit, stay, or down, stay. Then they get the child with autism out of the car. And they tether the child to the dog and then obviously have to turn their heads for a split second to grab a purse or another child. And the child with autism decides, oh, I'm not sticking around here any longer. And they go to bolt out into traffic. The dog will hold the child in place so that they aren't able to bolt out into the traffic or off the curb of a sidewalk, and long enough for the parent to get the situation under control. They aren't going to be the anchor for a long period of time, but a long enough period of time that everyone stays safe. So that's our first and primary training with these dogs. These dogs also provide what we call deep pressure visits, people with autism don't have the same sensory stimulation, and so you may see them slapping at their cheek or pinching themselves on their hand, and that's because if they don't do that, they don't feel the sensations the same as most people do. So our dogs provide a deep pressure visit. So if we give the command to the dog, they will go over to the child and they will apply pressure to the knee or onto the chest area. And that takes the thought process of, you know, hitting my cheek away from the child and onto the dog and starts petting the dog. And it totally kind of rewires the brain at that point where, oh, my dog's here, I'm going to focus on my dog instead of focusing on giving myself a red cheek. So they provide that. And then another training task that they do is called over visit. Some of the kiddos that we work with will have what we call breakdowns or meltdowns because they're just too overly stimulated. And oftentimes that means that they sit down, sit on the floor, lay on the floor. And our dogs, if we give them the command over visit, they will go and lay across the child's leg. Or some of our dogs are even providing kind of whole body deep pressure where they go from the chest to the knee, lay over the child or the youth, and provide that pressure that kind of brings the child around. And they start, hey, my dog's on me, start petting my dog, and the meltdowns are far less and don't last near as long.
So are there any challenges in matching the right dog with the right training to a child who needs it?
All of our dogs, when they've come up through the ranks of training and then spent time in advanced dog training with my staff trainers, and we decide at that point, you know, who would be best matched with this dog, and we look at our client wait list and whoever's near the top, we do the matching, and all of the dogs go out to the homes on a trial basis. We don't just hand over a dog and say, here you go, and walk out, and that's it. Our program is home-based. So we provide home-based training, and the families have been, when they get on our wait list, they have been attending our parent-only workshops and our family workshops. So they have been learning all along while they're waiting for their dog and attending training sessions. So they have a pretty good idea by the time the dog comes, but it's only there as a trial to see if the dog is a good match with the child and with the whole family unit. And, you know, our success rates are very high in our matching, so we obviously are doing something right.
Mm-hmm. In your time with this work, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, yes. Well, many, actually. But we matched a dog, several months ago now, with a 9-year-old girl, and she'd been nonverbal, and after 3 hours of the dog being there on the trial basis, and my trainer there as well to support the family and do training and orientation, the child up to that point had never spoke a word. They had never heard anything, and after 3 hours of the dog being in her presence, she said, "Come, doggy, come." And a lot of our families tell us that somehow, some way, these dogs seem to unlock what the child has been keeping inside. And so there is success stories of kids being totally nonverbal to one day talking in sentences. So it really brings out communication and expression. Another story that I will often tell when I do presentations, which really amazed me, is we were at a family workshop, and we often ask families that already have working dogs to join us and share their experiences of having the service dog. And this one mom showed up with her daughter's service dog. Her daughter was unwell and couldn't come, and she's standing in the gymnasium where we're holding the event, and a little girl was sitting on a bleacher, and she was pinching at the side of her teeth, and the dog started pulling on its handler until the handler got over to the little girl, and the dog immediately put its face in between the child's hand and the cheek and nudged its way in there so that his snout was right up against her cheek, and so she was no longer pinching at herself. She was, "What's this?" Stopped, realized it was the dog, and started petting the dog, and she never pinched at her cheek the remainder of our workshop, and the dog just stayed right with her. Even though it wasn't her service dog, it was just one of our service dogs that was there to share their family story, that dog never left her side, and that's exactly the support that she was used to providing to her girl at home, was to stop her from hitting her cheek. So that was, and I had just started at that point with the organization, and that just sealed the deal for me. That was amazing to see. And my final story is my own story with my son. When we got Matrix, our ADS ambassador dog, came to live with us, and my son has autistic tendencies, when he has two rare diseases. And so my husband and I had to stop going to the grocery store together as a family, because one of my son's fixations is chocolate chip cookies. And I always went, or he always went, and one of us would always stay home with our son. And then we got Matrix, and we then could go to the grocery store. So when Matrix came to live with us, I said, let's try to go grocery shopping as a family. And now we do all the time, because it's as if, you know, these dogs kind of rewire the thought process. And we get to the cookie aisle now, and my son gets one bag of cookies, and then we immediately say, okay, let's go get Matrix his cookies. And the reply is, yes, Mom, Matrix needs cookies. So it totally takes that fixation and reroutes it onto the dog. And it's these dogs are such great tools for that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Center for Teaching and Learning at U Windsor is calling for nominations for the GATA Awards for Educational Practice and Educational Leadership. These awards recognize contributions from graduate and teaching assistants to the University of Windsor's learning environment and aim to honor exemplary GAs and TAs who contribute to a positive, learning-centered environment at the university. The deadline for nominations is May 25th, 2020 at 5 p.m. Questions and comments about the awards for educational practice and leadership may be directed to Dr. Pierre Boulos at boulos@uwindsor.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jeff Passoff from Dignity Transport, and Vicky Spadoni told us a little bit about autism service dogs. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Constance Exley from Accessibility Canada. Tell me a little bit about Accessibility Canada.
Yeah, so Accessibility Services Canada is an organization that helps nonprofits and businesses and local governments understand their accessibility requirements for their legislation. And then we also provide a lot of hands-on and how-to training, including workshops and webinars on document accessibility, on website accessibility, so how do you create an accessible website, how do you evaluate your website for accessibility. We have webinars on things like how do you do social media accessibly, how do you post videos online to your website or YouTube and do accessible captioning. So lots of kind of sessions on teaching people how to do things. You know, we're a small company, and so we're not able to go out and help all of the clients that necessarily want assistance, but rather we feel like it's helpful to teach people how to do things so that they can do it themselves.
So
that's our main focus. Our roots come out of the nonprofit sector and some work that we did with, at the time, it was called the Accessibility Directorate of Ontario out of the Ontario government. And we did an 18-month project letting nonprofits in Ontario, about 60,000 of them, letting them know about the FIRST standard, which at that time was the only one that was legislated, the customer service standard, and about the AODA. That's our roots. And we've continued to try to provide information and education and training to sort of always keeping in mind nonprofits in the sense of doing as much as we can virtually through webinars and so on, so that organizations, whether they're small businesses or nonprofits that aren't close to Toronto where we're based, can still access that information.
So are there any challenges in providing these services and this training to these organizations?
Well, I guess one challenge, so we have sort of two streams to our work. One is, as I mentioned, 10 years ago, we started working with the Ontario government on year-long accessibility education initiative. At that time, that first project was with the Ontario Nonprofit Network, and the Ontario government has a grant called Enabling Change, and they make it available to a handful of provincial organizations every year. And every year for the last 10 years, we have been involved in designing and delivering and evaluating a year-long project that has been funded by the government through the Enabling Change Project in partnership with a provincial organization. So, you know, we did two with the Ontario Nonprofit Network, we did one with the Association of Ontario Health Centres, one with Ontario Camp Association, and we've done four now with the Ontario BIA Association. So those are great because, you know, organizations, provincial networks, as well as the organizations themselves that are part of those networks, that often don't have a lot of money. They're not big corporations. We have the funding to be able to provide that education and training with the assistance of the government. The other half of our work is, again, as I mentioned, coming out of our nonprofit roots, trying to provide that information and training in a way that they can access. So, again, we try to do lots virtually and at a price point that allows us, of course, that if we're running a business, staff to pay, but also keeps it affordable. So I would say that's the challenge is always not always, but often comes down to money. You know, money to implement the accessibility requirements under the legislation or, you know, money to do training. So small nonprofits, again, or small businesses don't necessarily have a professional development budget. So, you know, everything is a challenge.
So
that's what I'd say is that one of the main challenges is for the smaller organizations to be able to have the resources to be able to get the training, get the support that they need to be able to not only meet their accessibility compliance requirements, but also to go beyond that. Sometimes we've also seen challenges for smaller organizations that don't have, for instance, their own IT department, or even necessarily somebody that is on their staff that knows anything about website development. You know, again, that's another big ticket item. It's an important one, website accessibility, but it's difficult for small businesses or small nonprofits if they don't have a budget for it.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with this accessibility work, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, while there certainly can be a lot of criticisms about the AODA, so AODA is the Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities, Accessibility for Ontarians with Disabilities Act, there's a lot of holes that can be poked in it, and certainly, it doesn't make Ontario accessible 100%, but I think I'm a big supporter and fan of the legislation because before that, there was no incentive or motivation for any organization to think about accessibility. And so in 10 years that I've been working in this area, very focused and specific, legislation and accessibility is all we do, I have seen tremendous change in Ontario, and that has also then had a ripple effect out to other provinces. So I think that is a huge success, which I personally can't obviously take credit for passing the legislation, but being part of that, being part of this change, which has an impact on so many people's lives, I'm delighted to be involved and be part of a larger community doing that work. This is a small example, and it may be a small example, but also one that I'm very proud of, is last year, we were leading a project with the Ontario government and the Ontario BIA Association. So BIAs is an acronym for Business Improvement Association, and they are main street businesses in small towns all across Ontario. And there's probably about 300,000 businesses that are captured within local BIAs. And again, Main Street rural Ontario, it's really challenging at the best of times to run a business. And then, if you're having to add a lens of accessibility, you don't necessarily have a lot of resources in your community, you don't know anything about it, and yet the reality is that we live in an aging province, or a province where people are aging, and so it is something that people need to take consideration of. So under this last project, I developed and created a handbook with low-cost and no-cost ways that businesses and others, it's focused on businesses, but it's universally applicable to nonprofits or any other kind of organization, the ways that they can be looking to make their built environments more accessible. There's a misconception that, accessibility is focused only on built environments. So, we'd often hear, oh, we have steps into our store, so we can't become accessible, or we can't do anything in terms of the legislation. We don't need to comply because we have a heritage building and it's not accessible. We try to dispel that myth and say there's lots of things that you can be doing to make your built environments accessible that have nothing to do with stairs. Things like removing things that might block the entrance, planters or signage and that kind of thing, or color contrasting within the retail location or the building itself in terms of contrasting the floor with the walls, and signage, and ensuring that signage is in a font that's clear and easy to read and is of a sufficient size that people can read it as well. So there's lots and lots of tips in there. So that's a great handbook. If the government is printing those, they translated them and they're printing them, and they're available as a hard copy for free from the government Queen's printer. And you can also get an accessible PDF version on our website, which is accessibilitycanada.ca, under the resources. So that would be something that I would say I'm really proud of. It's it's very current. There wasn't anything out there that had that kind of very practical and simple information. And at the back, there's a chart that has a list of the things that you can do, and across the top it says no cost or low cost or medium cost or high cost. So you can kind of, as an organization, work your way through and think about the list and what you want to or what you're able to do with finances that you have. So that's an example of something I'm very proud of.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. My friends, I'm always pleased to hear that disability inspections are asking the questions beyond the obvious. What makes accessibility? What does it mean to those who are truly affected? Fact is, disability issues and true accessibility can't be summed up in a little box. It's not one size fits all. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.